was just a bunch of damaged people deciding we're not going to be those people anymore. We're going to change our names, be fabulous, and rule the world. And that's what it felt like. And some of them did.
Hello, my name is Kay Anderson, and you are listening to Lost Spaces, the podcast that mourns the death of queer nightlife. Every episode, I talk to a different person about a venue from their past, the memories that they created there, and the people that they used to know. So if you were to hold a gun to my head, let's say, and ask me to overly generalize and boil down the types of experiences that guests on this show have had when they first go to queer spaces, then I would say, first of all, no need to hold a gun to my head. I'll answer this question anyway. And second of all, they probably fit into two main categories. So on the one hand, there are those who feel instantly at home and like they've arrived, and they talk about their first time being like this aha moment where suddenly everything makes sense. And then on the other hand, there are those who feel like a bit of an outsider or a tourist in the space. And sometimes that goes away after they ease into the space or visit a few times and they better understand the culture and they know a few people. But sometimes they remain a tourist. And to be clear, I'm not saying tourist as though it's a bad thing. It's just a thing. And sometimes you're aware that this isn't for you, but you still get a lot of value from it. And that brings me to this week's guest, author, screenwriter, producer, Abdi Nazemian, who never stopped feeling like a tourist, but credits his Lost Space Disco 2000 at the Limelight in New York City with inspiring him to be passionate and become himself and experiment and be silly, which I think are kind of wonderful things. One more thing. We talk about the club kid scene in this episode, which was a movement that was happening in New York City in the early 90s and is probably best known because of the book and the movie Party Monster. And I don't think that you need to know much about the history of the scene to follow the conversation, but I just wanted to let you know that I'm going to include a few links in the show notes with a bit more detail if you want to find out more. Okay, I've said too much. Let's hear what Abdi has to say. So, if you think about the Abdi that showed up in New York City, how would you describe him?
Well, I showed up in New York City in September of 1998 for college.
Fine year.
Best year in music, by the way, which I'm happy to discuss. 1998, I've given it a lot of thought. But, you know, I'd spent 4 years in a boarding school in New England and Connecticut. It was a very isolated place, and I really craved being in a city, especially New York City, which back then represented everything that felt free and liberating to me. You know, I think I arrived in New York City with a lot of ideas about myself. Like at that point, I was very immersed in the arts. I was doing acting and writing and directing in high school, and I was very kind of countercultural in my fashion sense. But
yes. Okay, stop. Countercultural in your fashion sense. Describe that to me.
Well, so, you know, you have to understand the context of boarding school in the 90s. It's a very preppy place. It's a place where everybody's wearing their polos and listening to Simon and Garfunkel, even though it's the 90s, you know. At that point, the idea of kind of bringing counterculture into that environment wasn't that common. And I, about midway through high school, really discovered a lot of underground things that I loved. So I was wearing a lot of 70s clothes. I loved going to vintage shops and finding bell bottoms and bowling shirts and platform shoes and, you know, things that were very different. We also had a very loose dress code, but the idea of our dress code is like you had to wear collared shirts. But so that meant most people wore polo shirts or button downs. And so I would find these old polyester collar shirts where I'm like, it doesn't break the rules, but I clearly look like I'm breaking the rules, which was very fun. And I was...
And sweating a lot in polyester as well.
Well, it was New England. It was oh, often okay, very yeah. cold. But yes, it's not the most forgiving fabric. But, you know, when you're young, you can pull it off. Mm. And I mean, like I said, when I got to New York, I discovered a whole world of self-expression through fashion that was much more countercultural than what I thought I was doing in high school. But I certainly was somebody who presented at that point as very artistic and different and, for lack of a better word, queer or gay, because I was clearly battling against the norms of how people dressed. You know, I would do like to one of our school dances, I took one of my mother's purses that looked very feathered and I figured out a way to put it on my head and I wore it as a hat. It was like this giant feathered purse on my head. You know, so I would do pretty attention getting gender fucky things.
Okay. And so what was in Abdi's head at this time? Like, what were you?
Well, my mother's purse.
Inside your head, not on your head.
On my head was my mom's purse. In my head, I was really hungry for life. You know, I was hungry for everything an urban environment had to offer, for nightlife. I knew I was gay. I hadn't come out. Yeah, I mean, I'd come out to my high school English teacher. I hadn't come out widely yet. So I was very hungry to explore whatever queer life was. I didn't know what it was yet. I was hungry for the arts, for knowledge, you know, all that stuff, for a community. Yeah.
I'm going to take a wild guess and say that the queer scene in New England at your boarding school wasn't pumping.
Well, there was no queer scene at my boarding school. I mean, it was...
Did you check the boys' locker rooms?
Well... That's a very good, there's a question in there about, would you even count that as a queer scene? You know, I mean, of course, in boarding school, you know, it's men having sex with men. It's often in the form of hazing and non-consensual, power dynamics that are very common in those environments. I wrote a book about this,
And so they are actually common.
Oh, very common.
I always think that it's kind of exaggerated for movies.
No, it's very real. There was quite a culture of abuse and hazing when I was there. And I often have people tell me, you know, when I tell them I went to boarding school, they kind of present it as if it's some kind of appealing sexual fantasy. And I'm like, you have to remember, it's a group of people who are 14 years old, sent away from their homes, many of whom, like myself, are not emotionally ready for that, and then they're put in this environment where the power dynamics are very clear and there is quite a bit of hazing. And back then in the 90s, you had quite a bit of, you know, it didn't happen to me, but, you know, teachers abusing students, having relationships with students. It was quite common at the school I went to. So, and you kind of arrive and are taught that those are the rules of that environment, that
and it's just normalized.
And it's just normalized, and you don't have access to the internet or all these things that haven't been invented to check to see what's okay and what's not. You're just kind of told this is a powerful institution. You're so lucky to be here. Follow the rules. So it's not, you know, I mean, to describe it as a queer scene, it's like a really interesting question, actually, because it doesn't, if anything, it's almost like an anti-queer scene because it's so, it instills such fear and shame around being queer. Oh, God, I've stumped you. What's happening?
No, I was going to say. Okay, so first of all, this was a throwaway joke. I'm really, really sorry
but it led to such an interesting... No, I love it, though. I love it.
But can you be anti-queer and queer at the same time?
Of course.
So it could be queer, then?
Well, it of course. I mean, it all depends on how you describe it. But I think it's... it's to me, it's not just the word queer, but it's like scene or community. Like when I think of a queer scene,
of course,
I think of a place where you can be open about it, where you can have that sense of community. Anything that happened that was queer in that boarding school was either hidden and coded in a lot of shame, or it was presented in the context of bullying and hazing that took queer forms. You know, like I wrote in the novel that I wrote about boarding school, I describe some of the things that happened. You know, we would have prefects who would like take their clothes off and haze us with their bodies, or people who would like come on each other's doorknobs as a joke. You know, it's like that might read as queer to the outside world. I mean, to me, it felt like hazing and abuse.
And it's using the queerness as a form of abuse.
Well, yeah, because if you're experiencing it as I was, and at the same age where you're trying to figure out who you are, and you know that you are attracted to other boys, which in that era was, you know, a terribly shameful thing to be in that environment, you're associating that act with hazing and bullying. Your first experience of it is in a very negative context. And so that's where I would argue it's kind of anti-queer. I think I would have had an easier time coming out had I not experienced a lot of what I experienced there in terms of the kind of like sexual forms of hazing and
that's
behavior.
Interesting. So before you went to the school, had you had an inclination that you might not be heterosexual?
Yes.
And had you reconciled that with yourself?
Absolutely not. No.
Okay. All right. Cool. That's the way it's supposed to go.
Yeah. I came from an Iranian family, very culturally conservative, no exposure to queer life outside of Madonna at that age. You know, the worst years of the AIDS crisis in the US. So there was a lot of shame and stigma when it came to the community. And that was really the only messaging that reached me as a young person, again, outside of Madonna. But it was, she was very important. Yeah, I think to come to terms with it in a deep way took me much, much, much longer. I mean, well into my adult years.
And that was complicated by what happened at boarding school.
I think so, yes. I mean, look, life is a very complex thing where you can't pull one strand out and take anything out. I'm not implying that had I not experienced that kind of hazing in boarding school, I wouldn't have still had a fraught coming out. It was, again, like I said, from a culturally conservative community, coming of age in a time where being gay was filled with stigma, not a lot of positive role models out there. But I think to experience that kind of behavior at such a young age when I was still very sheltered was very damaging. And honestly, the vast majority of the bullying that took place was about being queer. I mean, that's what young boys were made fun of back then.
Absolutely.
The kind of subtext of almost all bullying was don't be gay. I mean, that was the message.
So then, if we think back to the first question about arriving in New York and who Abdi was at that time, had you come out by that stage?
No, I didn't come out. I mean, this is a very complicated thing, and I think it's useful to listeners out there to know that in my case, coming out happened over the course of a decade. I never came out wholesale. Like I came out to my parents in my mid-20s. The first person I came out to, as I mentioned, is my high school English teacher. So probably like 17 years old when I came out to him. And I was in my mid-20s by the time I came out to my parents, who were the last people I came out to. So, and in between that, I came out to people slowly. The beauty, to get back to 1998 for a sec, the beauty of being in New York in 1998 is I didn't feel like I had to come out to anyone. It felt like there were a group of people who recognized who I was based on what I wore and the fact that the minute I got to college, my dorm room was covered in photos of Marlena Dietrich and Joan Crawford. And it was like people understood and I found my community and I didn't.
Well, how could they pick up on the subtle hints you were laying down? I can't imagine. Must have been so astute.
Well, my parents didn't pick up on it. I was 10 years old when I turned our storage closet into the Madonna room, and they did not pick up on it. So there you go. I'm not joking.
But you had come out to yourself, crucially, by the time you got to New York. You were like, this is...
Yeah, I think that's a beautiful way to put it. Like, I think by that point, I'd come out to myself. And I wouldn't say I had come out to myself in high school. I think for at least the first half of high school, there was still that part of me that believed I could wake up one day and it would all have changed, you know, that it was a fate. Like, all the stuff that people would say was still in my brain. I think by college, by the time I arrived, I had accepted that this was who I was and that I was ready to find myself in this city.
And what do you remember most about those first days in New York?
Well, I mean, I vividly remember the way that you met people based on, like I said, the way that you presented. There was so much, you know, now I feel like young people have so much access to technology that like helps them sort out who is for them. And back then it was like, based on the way people presented themselves, you had this vibe of who they were and in their clothes and how they decorated their rooms and the music. You know, I remember arriving to my dorm and, you know, college dorm rooms, like a long hallway. And just based on like what music people were playing in their rooms, you're like, oh yeah, that's the person I want to meet. And that's the, and my very first week of college, we were at the orientation activities, and the orientation activities are quite boring and, you know, not really what a kid like me wanted to be doing. And I remember meeting a group of people immediately who just, we all looked at each other and we were like, do you want to get out of here and go to a nightclub? And we left. We just were like, we don't need to be at college orientation because we've already found each other and we don't want to be here. We want to be downtown. And so we went out.
But did you know these people that you'd agreed to go to the club with, or were they just randos that were in? Okay.
All new friends except for one who I went to high school with, who remained one of my best friends through college and through life. She still is. But other than that, it was all new people.
So this is like day one, two, three. You're like, everyone.
I'm pretty sure it was day. I think it was probably day two. I mean, memory is a hard thing.
It would be more poetic if we said it was day one. Can we just say that?
Let's just say it was day one. It was day one. It was day zero. It was day zero.
Fresh off the boat. Well, and so what was this club that you all embarked on a journey to?
Well, if memory serves, and let's just have it be the way that I think I remember it, I am almost positive it was Disco 2000 at the Limelight, which was a Wednesday night party. I hope I'm getting this right, because I'm pretty sure it was Wednesday night. And it absolutely blew our minds. I mean, nothing was the same after that first night. It was a whole, Disco 2000 was kind of the hub of the club kid scene. And from there, everything, it was like an octopus that had, you know, from there we found our way to other nightclubs and other parties and promoters and all that.
So I do want to find out about this. But first of all, I want to ask you, and I want your honest reflection here. If I were to suggest to you now, let's go out on a Wednesday night, how would you react?
As long as it was tea at 4 p.m., I would react. I mean, I have two children. I have two 12-year-old kids. My life is quite sedate. I tend to be in bed by 9 p.m.
So you're saying no. I think you're saying no.
Yes, pretty much. The only thing that I will stay up past 10 p.m. for is a Madonna concert. We all went to see her. Outside of that, I'm in bed. But I plan on having a midlife crisis when the kids go to college and you'll see me at the clubs again.
Okay. So you said that Disco 2000 blew your mind.
It did.
What specifically about it blew your mind?
I mean, it was the colors, the fashion, the give no fucks attitude of people. I mean, it was wild. You had like people like Amanda Lepore, who was in her prime there. You had Richie Rich and, you know, Jenny Talia, these people who were just, they looked like no one you'd ever seen before. So that's like just a sensual thing. The music, I mean, my God, the music was so visceral and new, and the community of it, it just felt like people were really doing something. But I think in a more analytical way, it was very liberating because it felt like everybody there was making up their identity. They had adopted new names, like club kid names. They had adopted new ways of being and looking. And growing up, I was very much a kid who was just very, I never fit into the world. And I loved old Hollywood. You know, I mentioned Joan Crawford and Dietrich, and I love so many other of the great Hollywood stars. But I always loved this idea of this fantasy world where people got to change their names and become these stars and leave their traumatic past behind. You know, I would always look at like the Marilyns and Judys and Jones and be like, that's what I want. And I feel like in a way, the club kid scene was that in this new queer guise. It was just a bunch of damaged people deciding we're not going to be those people anymore. We're going to change our names, be fabulous, and rule the world. And that's what it felt like. And some of them did. I mean, RuPaul came out of that scene and lots of other people who've changed the world, and others crashed and burned. And we'll discuss that in time.
So where do you fit on that spectrum?
You know, I fit on that spectrum as a tourist, really. Like, I wasn't one of them. I mean, I kind of was, in the sense of I was part of the scene for a year and I did it up and I created myself. But after Michael Alec killed Angel, which, you know, this is a subject of Party Monster, both the documentary, which is stunning, and the feature film and a book by James St. James. You know, after that happened, me and my friends from Columbia, that's where I went to school, Columbia University in very, very uptown New York, very far from the downtown scene. After that murder happened, we all just retreated. So that was it. I mean,
So what year did that happen? I thought that was earlier in the 90s.
No, I think that was, I'd have to look it up, but if memory serves, it was the summer after my freshman year. So I'm going to Google this.
We will be right back after this Googling break.
Let's see. Killing of Angel Melendez was... Oh, wait, you know what? I got the years wrong. I'm such an idiot. See, this is what happens when you interview old people. It was 94 that I arrived in New York, not 98. This is why you're confused. It was 98 when I arrived in Los Angeles.
Oh, okay.
So I arrived in New York in 1994, and Michael Alec...
Should we just start the whole interview again then?
You can just have this be a part of it so everybody understands that when you're nearing 50 and you have two children, your brain is mush.
It's not mush. You're doing a good job. Oh, sorry, that sounded really patronizing. Okay, so forget everything you knew. You got there in 1994. Okay, cool. Because I was sitting here thinking, I'm sure the club kids were earlier than 1998.
You're like, what happened?
But I won't say anything because I wasn't there.
Do you know, our son makes fun of me all the time because I never remember my age. People ask me how old I am and I always freeze, and it takes me a minute because I just, at a certain age, you stop caring and you're like,
yeah, it's less important.
It is. And I always turn to my kids. I'm like, how old am I? And then my son's like, how do you not know your age? I'm like, you should hope that as you get older, you forget your age. Yes. So I arrived in 1994 and that happened in 1996. So we had about a year and a half, 2 years in that scene. And then we retreated very far away from it. So I wouldn't define myself as somebody who, you know, to me, I was a tourist in that scene. When I look back, it's like I was able as a college student to dip in and out of it as needed and take a lot from it. You know, I definitely credit that scene for giving me a giant dose of liberation, of creativity, of boldness. But once it became clear that there was a very dark side to it, I got the hell out.
You made reference to the fact that you, like other people that were there, created yourself through that scene. Can you talk to me about that a little?
I think as queer people, especially back then, the idea of creating yourself was almost a survival necessity, because at that time, I was still in the closet to my parents, to my family, to my whole cultural community, and I felt like I had to play a certain role in that environment. And so it did feel like if I was going to have this other part of me, this liberated club part of me, it was going to have to be an act of self-creation. It couldn't be a person. I mean, of course, now I understand that that is a divided self and I've done the work to be one whole human. But back then it did feel like I was different people. And the idea of being able to put a mask on and off was very normal for a lot of us, I think. And that's why, again, that's why old Hollywood, that's why drag is so rooted in that, and club kids were rooted in that. It's really the idea of being able to to shed the skin that you're told to wear and create a whole new skin.
Yeah. But in the act of creating this new self, were you creating the person who you always wanted to be, or were you creating the person that you thought everyone else wanted from you?
Honestly, neither. I think I was creating a persona that was very risk-taking and bold and bright that I needed to create in those young years in order, as a stepping stone, to be the person I wanted to be, which is really who I am now, which is like a writer and a dad who spends most of his time at home. I mean, I still love dancing and music, but I mean, in many ways, the person I created back then was just as false as the closeted kid. You know, it wasn't who I was. I'm not that person. If I was, I never would have left that scene. I'm not a club kid deep in the depths of my soul. There are people like Amanda Lepore who are still doing their incredible thing, who were the DNA of that scene. But it was useful. It was useful.
Mm-hmm. And so was it like being a super exaggerated version of who you wanted to be and then figuring out which bits to dial back?
I almost think it's more like as a writer. Like when I think of myself as an author, the first book I wrote, which will never be published, is on a shelf because my agent recognized wisely that it was basically a copy of Armistead Maupin's voice, who was one of my favorite writers growing up, who wrote the Tales of the City series and was a very groundbreaking gay novelist.
Ooh, and a new book coming out, everyone.
Yes.
Go check it out.
That's right, Mona of the Manor. I loved him so much that I basically adopted his voice in writing my first novel, and it was through that I got closer to my own voice, and now I feel like I have a voice as a novelist. I think similarly, when you're young, it's very useful sometimes to try on different guises, and to me, that year or so of existing in that club kid world was a guise that allowed me, because it was so extreme and it was such a shock. You know, that was like when you're coming from a boarding school in New England and you're plunked into Disco 2000 with people who have like bird cages hanging from their ears and, you know, safety pins all over their bodies and just the most exaggerated body imagery you've ever seen. It shocks you into taking risks. And so I think for me, it was almost like I got to exist in their voice, in their world for a little bit. And it gave me the confidence to go out and find my own, if that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah. But did you come up with your own club kid name?
I did. It was Papa Smurf.
And why?
Well, I always loved the Smurfs from when I was very young. I grew up, a lot of my younger years were...
But why wouldn't you be Smurfette?
Well, because my friend was Smurfette. My friend was Smurfette. And I guess always, now I'm really realizing this, all of my nicknames have been some variation of like Papa, Daddy. People always ask me because my handle is Ab Daddy, which has been my nickname for a long time. And I guess that was always in some way the role I played. I always, from a young age, I knew I wanted to be a dad. There was always this like draw to being like the paternal figure of the group. But Papa Smurf, I mean, it largely came out just because I love the Smurfs. They were very big in France when I was growing up. They were Les Schtroumpfs over there. And I had this is so ridiculous, but I just loved wearing royal blue. And I used to go out to the clubs in this royal blue ski suit. You know, those one-piece ski suits.
And all of your fashion choices lead to lots of sweating.
They do. You're right. You're right. But, you know, I'm not a very big sweater. So maybe that's why.
Oh, lucky you.
But yeah, and so I used to like put blue paste in my hair. My favorite thing, which was an homage to Hedy Lamarr, the old Hollywood actress who also invented Wi-Fi, basically. She wore in a very famous outfit she wore. She had this diamond here on her forehead. And so I got this Smurf. I think it was Hefty. And I put this leather strap on him and I would wear him here. Like, so I had a Smurf on my forehead, like it was a jewel. And I felt so glamorous.
This daddy thing that you mentioned, is it a self-appointed role or is it the role that other people place you in?
It's both, I think. I mean, now let's get to 1998. Actually, 1998.
Do you need to check anything?
I'm sure. No, I'm sure. Chronology has come back to me. When I moved to Los Angeles in 98, I moved with my best friend, Jenny, from high school. Still my best friend. And everybody called us Mummy and Daddy because we were just kind of like the Mummy and Daddy of our chosen family. And we gave a lot of our friends names. Like I have one of my closest friends I call my son, you know, I joke that he's my firstborn. Like, so he's our son, and we had a newborn, and one of our friends was Auntie, and one of our friends was Granny. And we kind of like cobbled together, as many queer people do, a little family. And Daddy was just the natural thing. I mean, that's just what people called me. And I think I also liked it and adopted it. And like I said, from a very young age, I always knew I wanted to be a father. I didn't know how that would happen. And I never connected my nickname to that. It wasn't like I even thought that deeply about it. But
manifesting.
Yeah, but you know, it's one of those things, just like in a great book or a great work of art where you start to see the connective tissue. You're like, oh, wait a minute, this actually has been connective tissue in my life. I never thought about it, that I was Papa Smurf and then became Ab Daddy, that all my nicknames have somehow connected.
Okay, let's come back from 1998, back to 1994. That first night that you were at Disco 2000, you've taken in all the smells, you've listened to all the sounds, you've experienced that place. What's the feeling the next day?
It was a feeling of knowing that this was going to be the world I existed in for a little while. Like, I knew that wasn't a night that was going to exist in the past. It was going to be my life, at least for the time being. Every single one of us who went there was hooked. You know, there's some nights you have a crazy night out and you wake up and you're like, that's over. And then there's other times where you go out and you wake up and you realize, oh, I just experienced a whole subculture that is going to be a defining part of my life. And I think
I
knew.
Need to go and buy a leather strap to stick a Smurf to.
That's right. Oh, of course. Of course. I mean, it absolutely defined my fashion. That's for sure.
Okay. So that's it. Like in the days following, what did it come to mean to you in that year?
It was probably one of the most transformative years of my life. I mean, there's years that go by and nothing really changes, which is not always a bad thing. It's just they're not years that you change. There's years that really transform you as a human being. And I would say that year was one of those. I mean, I was a different person when that year ended. And a lot of it had to do with that subculture of the clubs and what it brought out of me, just this sense of living in a much bolder, riskier, more curious way. And it was fun. I mean, I don't want, you know, we're having such an analytical conversation. I don't want to like downplay the fact that it was fun. I mean, that was the key. That was the real key. It was just so much fun. Everybody felt so liberated. There was such a sense of community. Everybody danced together. Everybody loved the same things. And it felt like a little secret that belonged to us. You know, there was no internet disseminating this culture yet. I mean, over time, club culture would filter into the mainstream, but it still felt like this little pocket of the world that was just ours and nobody else had access to. It felt really special and beautiful. And I think the other thing that I'm thinking about it out loud that was really unique about it is I don't want to downplay how much HIV and AIDS defined that time. You know, we're talking about still the worst years in New York City, which is one of the hardest hit cities in the whole world at that time. But one of the most amazing things looking back is it wasn't about sexual liberation. Like there was no, in all those years of being a club kid, I never hooked up. You know, I was basically celibate through all my young years because I was so afraid of sex, which is a very, yes. I've also written about this in a novel about those years, but I really appreciate looking back that the club scene and the club kid scene was not about a sexualized environment. It was not about like only gay men. It was men, it was women, it was people who were fucking experimenting with gender. It was drag, it was all of it. And as somebody who was in a place of still being very afraid of sex because of all the messaging that hit me around HIV and AIDS, it felt like a very unique place that gave me the queer liberation I needed without having it be rooted in sex, which is often the case.
Yeah.
And it's very unique. And this is not something I've really spoken about or even, this is why it's so cool to do interviews like this. You kind of piece stuff together, but yeah. nobody was trying to make themselves sexually attractive in that environment. That's what's so interesting. We just wanted to look wild.
There's something that's kind of sticking in my brain from what you said earlier. And I'm not sure what the specific words were, but you gave the impression that you were... No, actually, the specific words were you were a tourist in that space. You mm-hmm. talked about yourself as being an outsider in that space. Is that something that you are retrospectively applying, or were you always aware of that when you were there?
I don't know that I would have used that word back then, because retrospect gives you the ability to see certain things. Mm-hmm. But I was definitely aware of the difference between myself and some of my friends from college who were going into those spaces and the people for whom those spaces were their whole existence. Because there were people, of course, who are older than us, who weren't students, who were at that point making their living as artists, DJs, in fashion. You know, they were, the club life was their daytime and their nighttime. Mm-hmm. Whereas for me, you know, oftentimes we would be, and I loved this, but we would be at the clubs until 10 a.m. and go straight to class. And I have so many memories of going right into class at my, you know, my Ivy League college in my club outfit with like makeup dripping on my face and and sit down and still get straight A's. You know, I'm so proud of this. Like, I did quite well in college. I don't want to imply that I wasn't working hard. And so I suppose in that sense, I understood that I had a daytime life and I had a nighttime life, and they weren't necessarily connected. Mm-hmm. I also have to say, as somebody who is so many things that don't fit together, Iranian, gay, all these things that never computed together, especially back then, I always feel like an outsider in spaces. Always.
Always?
Almost. I mean, not in my own home now that I created, where I get to, you know, bring together everything with, but yeah, I mean, well, like when I go visit my Iranian community, there's a piece of me they'll never understand, even though they've come to accept it. And similarly, when I exist in the vast majority of spaces in the Western queer community I exist in, I always feel a divide because there's such a lack of understanding toward my part of the world and what the experience of being queer when you're from the Middle East is. And I don't ever feel fully one with kind of the Western queer world. So yeah, I suppose being an outsider, but I also, I think I've come to accept that that's a real asset, you know?
Elaborate.
I think that being an outsider in spaces, especially when you're growing up, forces you to learn empathy in a way that's very different than if you are an insider in your space at all times. Because you have to accept that no one community, no one person, no one family, no one anything can give you everything you need. And you're going to have to learn to forgive. And it's a very deep thing. I mean, I have noticed it a lot. You know, now we're raising our kids here in the United States, but we have, you know, they're different in the sense of they have an Iranian dad and they have, you know, one American dad, and my husband's parents are divorced and his stepfather's Lebanese and they're Muslim. Like, they have a lot of diversity within their family. And I really have observed in our own children that when they enter these spaces, like different communal spaces where the rules are different, they have developed this ability to forgive and understand and know that, okay, like the values in this home might be a slight nudge to this side than the values in that home. And that doesn't mean that we still don't stand firm in our values, but we have to learn to exist in that space and forgive. And I've, in my opinion, the real crisis we're facing in this world is a lack of empathy and conversation. And there's a lot of people who just want to shut doors these days versus walking through them and taking the risk. And I think that that's what I learned from always being an outsider. And I invite being an outsider. I like going to speak to communities that might not get me or know who I am, because it's an opportunity to make real change.
Can I just ask a quick follow-up question? So you've used the word forgive a few times. Mm-hmm. And I just want to clarify, do you mean like accept differences?
It's deeper than accept differences, I think. I mean, I do, of course, think we have to accept differences. But I think forgiveness implies that you have to accept not just a difference, but accept that a certain person or community or environment or scene or whatever is not going to give you everything you want from them and don't owe you that. You know, I think a lot of humans, especially, again, like this is a, to me, this is a very Western world thing. It's not as much of a thing in the Eastern world, but there is a real sense of like unforgiving individualism where life is about living on your own terms and anyone who doesn't accept 100% of who you are doesn't deserve to be a part of your life. I grew up in a world where nobody was ever going to accept 100% of who I was because my cultural community was in a place where they didn't even acknowledge homosexuality. Mm-hmm. And the gay community at that point was just nowhere near an understanding of a more global intersectional queer experience. So I never had the luxury of feeling like someone was going to accept me 100% growing up. And I think it forced me to learn to forgive others, not meaning that I want them to accept differences or I want to accept their differences. It's about learning to accept what a person is willing to give or what a scene is willing to give or what a community is willing to give openly and say, I appreciate that. And then the parts they're not giving, you're going to have to seek elsewhere, often in yourself, you know, often you're going to have to find that in yourself. But yeah, does that make sense?
But why is it forgiveness then?
Because I think there's often a lot of blame put on people who are not able to give you something, like it's their fault. You know, I mean, it's mm-hmm. taken me a long time to think this way, but I think we have to be more forgiving of the circumstances of times and places and where people come from and how they're raised. And I know as a person who moved to the Western world, you know, my parents had to flee the revolution. You know, they weren't raised the way I was. I have to do the work to understand, you know, when I was young, I blamed a lot. Like I blame, like, why can't you accept me? Why am I not more embraced for being gay? Why is it so hard to be queer in this community? And now it's not that that hurt isn't still there. And it's not that I don't want, I do everything I can to make the world better for other queer Middle Eastern people. I mean, I feel like that's my biggest mission with my work. But I think a lot of that is about, to me, the word is forgiveness. And maybe that's the wrong word in for other people, but it's about forgiving what somebody can't give you.
Sorry, I feel like I'm interrogating you today.
No, it's good. I like an interrogation. I like it. It gets me closer to an understanding of the self, which I guess is what I want.
Yeah, because I guess the opposite of blame to me is not forgiveness. I guess that's why I'm struggling with it.
Is it acceptance?
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah.
But I understand. I appreciate what you're... Like, I understand.
But...
I understand.
I think those are, you know, they're slightly different words that can maybe, as words often do, have different connotations to different people. To me, acceptance feels more, I guess, slightly more passive than forgiveness. To me, forgiveness requires a little more work on the part of the person doing the blame. It requires a little more acknowledgement that maybe the blame was misplaced. Whereas acceptance is just like, yeah, I accept that that's who you are, bye. You know, whereas forgiveness is a deeper sense of peace, I think, can come from it.
Yeah, I get that. I think maybe I interpret forgiveness as the act of moving beyond blame.
Mm-hmm.
So first of all, you have to have placed blame in order to forgive rather than just accepting from the get-go.
Oh, well, I did place blame. I think most young people do. I mean, is there any teenager who doesn't place blame for
their life on? You're not my mom.
It's developmentally appropriate to place blame as a young person, I think. I think it's part of the... You know, I have two 12-year-olds. I'm seeing the kernels of it now. It's not, it's as it should be. Young people.
How many slammed doors do you hear in a day?
Luckily, none.
It's coming. It's coming.
It's coming. But it's okay. Like, I think that that's what youth and adolescence should be. There should be a period of feeling that the world is unjust as it is. Mm-hmm. Blaming those who came before you as is developmentally appropriate. But then the question is, how do we grow up? How do we find peace? And like I said at the beginning, one of the things about existing in a scene like the club kid scene and like any queer space, I think, I mean, this is not just in the club scene, but just with my queer friends, is there's a lot of people who don't grow into acceptance, forgiveness, or whatever the word is. There's so many people who destroy themselves through drugs, through suicide. I've had countless friends who are not with us anymore, as I think every queer person I know my age has. I ask myself these questions all the time, like, what are the things that helped me survive where so many of my loved ones didn't? I mean, and I do think forgiveness and acceptance and moving through the blame is really important to finding some sense of peace as you grow older. Otherwise, it eats you alive. I mean, blame eats you alive. And I say that also in terms of blame on ourselves. I spent a lot of years blaming myself, not forgiving myself, feeling guilty for being who I was, for shaming my family or my culture, not being what I was supposed to be. You know, it's everything I'm saying applies to our relationship to ourselves too. Forgiving yourself.
But then I know you're trying to like change the subject to like what we're actually here to talk about today, but let me just quickly pick up on that, because you spent years blaming yourself, but then at the end of that, did you forgive yourself or accept yourself?
Well, both. Both, but again,
no, I need you to pick one.
I have to pick one. But then if no, I say I accept myself, do I not forgive myself?
So maybe it's not that they're opposites. Maybe they're in like some kind of triangle. Maybe if we can diagrammatically think of it that way. Blame, acceptance, forgiveness.
I would love, this feels like the kind of thing we need a whole symposium on, because I do, to me, they feel very different. Like to accept something to me can be very begrudging. You know, it can be like, well, I accept it. It's not what I want. I'm not really at peace with it, but I accept it. Fine. That's the way things
are. Okay. Yeah, yeah.
Forgiveness to me is an action. It's more like you really, in order to forgive yourself, have to do some deep work on yourself, on why did you blame yourself? What did you blame yourself for? What were the circumstances of that blame? What led you to feel that way? Why are you holding on to it all these years later? Why does it still affect you? You know, all that stuff feels more than just accepting and moving on. It requires your participation in a deeper way, I think. But that's, again, this is how I define them and experience them. That's these are broad words.
Yes. Sorry, I've taken us off in lots of the wrong directions. But so let's go back to Disco 2000. But I'm afraid the question I'm going to ask though is no less probing and deep.
Oh, probe away.
Probe. I'm interested in picking up the conversation that you had about not being sexual at that time. And being afraid of HIV. Mm-hmm. And did that just apply to all corners of your life? That just was not on the cards? You just were not interested in getting down?
Oh, I was interested. I was just
sorry,
scared.
I worded that badly. So were you not actively seeking the getting of the down?
No, not at all. I mean, it just wasn't even in my physical vocabulary at the time. I mean, the most would be being on a dance floor with some like light touch or something, you know. I mean, there would be moments like that, and even that probably was post Disco 2000. It was as I got closer into my junior senior year. But you know, even in my first relationship, which was in my 20s, I barely was able to be sexual because I was so afraid. There was a genuinely deep terrifying fear that was put in me from a very young age. And I've spoken to other people from my generation who share it, so I know I wasn't alone. You know, I wrote a novel called Like a Love Story, which there's a character very much inspired by me named Reza, who moves, he's Iranian, and moves to New York in 1989.
Wait, are you sure it's 1989?
Oh my God, I'm never gonna live this down. Oh God, please, please make fun of me. Actually, making fun of me is how you make me most comfortable. I'm now more relaxed. It's how I grew up. That's a very Iranian thing. I wrote this book, and in the book, the character of Reza, he is very, very afraid of sex because of HIV. And, you know, it was 1989, and he's Iranian and all that. And by the end of the book, he gets over it. And the number of readers who read the book and are so frustrated with him for being so afraid for the whole book. The book takes place over one school year.
Wow.
And I often tell those readers, I'm like, if you're frustrated with him who gets over it by the end of one school year in 1989, you have to understand I was in that state until my mid-20s or even more. I think a lot of people don't remember what that time felt like. And I think there haven't been enough stories about my particular generation. Like, I was not the generation on the front lines of the AIDS mm-hmm. epidemic. So I wasn't the generation that was most impacted. And I also wasn't the generation that got to experience gay life and sex once AIDS was somewhat treatable. You know, it started to become, you know, the protease inhibitors came out in the mid-90s, like things started to change. Mm. I really grew up, like I came of age, hit puberty, realized I was gay at a time when all I knew of gay life was that it was a death sentence and that it was the most horrible thing. And it was a very common thing to hear people I knew say that AIDS was, I mean, I can't even repeat it. It's so horrible. I put it in the book, but that it was like a good thing. It was killing off all the gay people. People were celebrating. I mean, it was a horrific thing. And, you know, the government, I'm sure you probably know this, but for those who don't, I mean, the government in the United States was the Reagan presidency. I mean, Ronald Reagan didn't even say the word AIDS until 4 years into the epidemic, let alone do anything. And it was just, there was this constant messaging that was like, you should be dead. And if you're gay, you will be dead. And I took a long time to shake that off. You know, it really was hard. It was very hard. And I think in some ways, it might have saved my life, too, because I didn't take any risks. And maybe that was part of the goal of the messaging. But it did instill a fear and a stigma and a shame in me that took quite a bit to overcome.
How did you overcome it?
Oh, gosh. I mean, therapy. Quite a bit of therapy. Writing. I mean, writing really helped. Writing, to me, is a form of therapy. If you do it from an honest place, it really helps you get stuff out. I've been able to say things through my characters that I would never be able to say. I mean, that novel, Like a Love Story, says more about what I went through as a teen than I could ever say in words, because it's too much, it's too painful, it's too complex. Like, I've had people come to me, like close people, like one of my mom's cousins who I adore and I'm very close with, who read that book and took me out to a meal and just said, I had no idea what you were going through at that time. And how would she? It's not her fault. Like, I hadn't come out. No one knew I was gay. I was just sitting in my room terrified because the newspaper would arrive to our house with headlines about AIDS and photos of men like me dying. And I was a kid, you know, I was too young. And yeah, it really, it's a hard thing, but what else? How else did I overcome it? Yeah. And of course, community, friendship, support, other humans who make you feel like you aren't guilty of something just for existing.
Yeah, humans are okay.
Well, some humans are.
Yeah. Yeah, and like, apologies for this line of questioning. I guess for me, I also grew up in that era of like, oh, I think you're going to be gay when you get older, therefore you're going to get AIDS, therefore you're going to die. Oh, sucks to be you. You're a terrible person. And I don't know if I'm ever going to completely rid that shame or that voice in the back of my head that tells
really?
Me that I shouldn't be enjoying sex, that I should expect the worst for myself. Because I was so, it was just such a formative part of my development.
So you're saying you still feel that way?
Not like on the same scale as I would have
no,
when
but
I was
it's
a teenager.
There, of course.
But like every now and then there is that voice that's like, yeah.
The thing about those voices, though, for me, is that, of course, to some extent, they're still there. I experience that when I'm writing these stories, and suddenly I realize it's so easy for me to write about that shame or guilt because it's still somewhere inside me. It's like any piece of your memory or
tapping
being is still... Yeah, it's hiding there. But I do think, personally, I really... It's amazing to me to even say this now because I spent so many years just feeling so guilty and ashamed about sex and sexuality. Like, I don't feel that way anymore. I can talk, and even this conversation, I would never have had this conversation. You know, it almost feels like back then to acknowledge the guilt and shame would have made me guilty and ashamed. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
As often is the case, when you can speak about the problem openly, it means that you've already shed a lot of that shame because you're not keeping it in. So much of my problems were about keeping stuff in and
bottling it in. Yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, I guess so. There's like a piece of you that still feels ashamed or guilty or like you deserve to be punished somehow. Is that?
Yeah, I guess it's this thing, like, we have all been socialized in cultures that are homophobic. So how could you not come away from that without being, like, a little homophobic, right?
Sure.
And how do you deprogram yourself if it's so baked in?
Those are great questions.
Oh, do you have the answer? I was expecting you to tell me how to do it.
Okay, well, here we go. But I think number one... one thing I will say about deprogramming yourself from things that you were raised with is our brains are quite malleable. Like, this is something I've been researching a lot because I'm really engaged right now in the debate about children and technology because we have two 12-year-olds who do not have phones and are begging for phones. And so we've been doing a lot of reading on this.
Are you going to make them write an essay to, like, plead their case? I feel like that's something you would do.
There is no case. It's a hard no for now. But, you know, in reading, because I'm very interested in what technology's done to my brain. I'm trying to be on social media a lot less these days. But in reading about this, even our adult brains are very, the neuroplasticity of them allows them to be changed. I think a lot of it is habit. Like, I've noticed it when I'm on my phone more, if I'm on social media more for promotional purposes, I feel the pieces of my brain like firing in a different way than when I'm in a relaxed, peaceful state reading a book. Like, and in the same way, I think a lot of these things are habits that if you manage to figure out the code to what it means for you, like I will say, since we're talking about sex and sexuality, and maybe this is just a very mundane observation, but one of my best therapists, I've had quite a few, but one of my best therapists made an observation when I was in my 20s and finally starting to have more of a sexual life about, you know, what you have to, he told me, what you have to understand is your emotional state when you are going into a sexual encounter. Are you going into it from a place of trying to escape your loneliness or your fears, or are you going into it from a place of celebrating your body and wanting to connect? And if you can pinpoint that emotional state before you go into it, because my problem was it would always make me feel horrible. I would have sex and I would feel guilty, ashamed, all the stuff you're talking about. That was a revelatory thing to me. And I remember feeling like, okay, I'm going to do this. I'm not going to put myself in situations when I'm approaching it from a place of escaping loneliness or shame or trying to dull a feeling. And over time, my relationship to sex changed because I stopped using it in that way. And also, I don't really hide it. Like, one thing I realized when I was young is a lot of my gay friends would hide the sexual side of their life from their straight friends or their community. They would just have their little, and I was like, you know what? That doesn't work for me. Like, this kind of divided self doesn't work for me. I have to be open about it. Otherwise it feels like I'm putting myself back in a closet, which for me is not emotionally healthy. So these are just examples that work for me. They're not, the problem with humans is there's not one answer that works for everyone always.
But wait, hang on. So you would tell all your friends about the sex that you were getting up to so you wouldn't have to hide
it? It's not that I would tell them all that. It's not like I would announce it to everyone.
So
but
you didn't
I wouldn't
bring pictures?
Of course not. But my point is I wouldn't make a point of hiding it. Like, to give you one example, in the early days, this is pre-Grindr, I met a guy on a site called Manhunt, which I guess was the Grindr of the day, and we dated. We met and we immediately hit it off and we dated. And when it came time to meet our friends, he said, I went to meet his friends and he lied. He made up a story about how we met. And I broke up with him. I was like,
I can't remember.
It was like we met at a party. I think it was party. Library would have been better. But that was the kind of thing that I immediately pinpointed as a deal breaker for me.
Really?
Yeah. I knew that if I was going to have to tell a lie to everyone in my life about how I met the person I was dating, it would trigger emotions of shame and this feeling that something about how we met was wrong. Like, why can't we tell people? Did we do something shameful by going to some gay site? Like, what's wrong with that? What did we do that's wrong? If something has to be hidden from even your closest friends, then it implies that you've done something you should feel guilty about.
Yeah, but I mean, obviously I can't speak on his behalf. Should we do a shout out for him? What's his name?
No, we're not going to do that.
Obviously I can't speak on his behalf, but surely the reason that he lied was because of that shame, like, and he just didn't want to deal with it in that moment.
No, but I didn't break up with him, like, on the spot right then.
It would have been pretty cunty if you did, though.
I know, but I'm not that person. I'm too concerned with other people's feelings.
Okay.
Look, you're right. I mean, there's a different version of who I was back then that might have recognized a piece of my own shame in his, and we would have connected, but that also wasn't who I was back. I was too young to do that. You know, I think now I have the kind of marriage and relationship where we can have those kinds of deep conversations. I think back then I was still piecing stuff together. I was still very young. I was just discovering how to exist as a sexual gay person. And these are just things I'm giving as examples of what I still feel that too many queer people I know have to hide so much of who they are from who they love. And if you can get to a place of not doing that, it does feel better, you know, at least for me, again, for me. And similarly, knowing how to care for yourself, you know, I mean, for me, writing, journaling, meditation, I mean, all these things of like not seeking, it goes back to that question about blame, like not seeking others to solve your problem. I mean, ultimately, I think the thing we realize is even though our blame and our shame came from a homophobic world, the world can't take it away from us. That's our job when we're adults. Mm. No one else can wipe it away. No one's love, nobody's acceptance is gonna make you wake up and forget decades of shame from your formative
years.
What about
3 liters of ice cream? Would that help?
Oh, ice cream does help. I eat ice cream all the time. Of course ice cream helps. Ice cream helps a lot. Yes.
We have veered dangerously far away from
I know,
Disco
we've said about two words about Disco 2000.
So let's wrap it up, maybe.
Okay.
And let me ask you one final question. And hopefully it'll stick to one question and I won't be like, well, what do you mean by that? So let's just see how we go on. What did Disco 2000 teach you about yourself?
I think Disco 2000 taught me, most importantly, that I was a person who could quickly acclimate to new environments. Mm. I don't know that that would have been my answer when I was 18 years old at Disco 2000. In retrospect, what I can recognize as a pattern in my life is that I jump into new things, be it a new world, a new subculture, a new club, a new career, a new challenge, and I'm able to quickly understand the rules of the environment, adapt, and give myself fully to it. And I think that was something I really experienced in Disco 2000 for the first time. I think before that, like with boarding school, which we talked about, it took me a solid year and a half to acclimate to that environment. Mm. It took me a long time to learn the rules of that world and understand how to be in that world. Whereas with Disco 2000, I walked into a whole universe that was new and different, where everything that I knew to be true was not true anymore. And I feel like overnight I just got it. And I'm like, I love this world and I'm going to immerse myself and I'm going to be this. And it was a really empowering thing because over time I kept doing that over and over again.
Hmm. Well, that's a wonderful gift.
Do you have a follow-up?
No, I'm going to like keep it at that. I'm going to keep it at that. Do you have any memories of Disco 2000 or maybe clubbing from your own queer scene that you want to share? Well, if you do, I want to hear all about it. So why don't you get in touch? I want to create the biggest online record of people's memories and stories of queer clubbing, but I can't do it alone and I need your help. Go to lostspacespodcast.com, find the section Share a Lost Space, and then tell me all about what it is you got up to. You can also reach out to me on Facebook and Instagram or TikTok, where my handle is Lost Spaces Pod. Find out more about Abdi by following him on Instagram or Twitter, where his profile is AbDaddy, which you would know if you listened to this episode, and I know you have listened to this episode. I'm not sure why I said that in such an accusatory way. Or you can visit his website, abdinazimian.com. If you liked this episode, I would really appreciate if you subscribed, left a review on your podcast platform, or just told other people who you think might be interested in giving it a little listen too. My name is Kay Anderson, and you have been listening to Lost Spaces.